All right, I want to pick up where we left off in 2 Chronicles. We left off in chapter 18. And now we're going to be dealing with a king of Judah, and his name is Jehoshaphat. He's actually the son of Asa. We read all about Asa and how he started out really well in terms of his spiritual commitment to God, but he kind of, just had a bad finish. Nevertheless, he did have this son who became king in his place, and Jehoshaphat was a really good king in the sight of God, but he has made some pretty big mistakes, and I think we can really glean from it. But beginning with this verse 1 of chapter 18 of 2 Chronicles, it says, "Now Jehoshaphat had great riches and honor, and he allied himself by marriage with Ahab. Some years later, he went down to visit Ahab in Samaria, and Ahab slaughtered many sheep and oxen for him and the people who were with him, and induced him to go up against Ramoth-Gilead. Ahab, king of Israel, said to Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, 'Will you go with me against Ramoth-Gilead?' And he said to him, 'I am as you are, and my people as your people, and we will be with you in the battle.' Moreover, Jehoshaphat said to the king of Israel, 'Please inquire first for the word of the Lord.' The king of Israel assembled the prophet's 400 men and said to them, 'Shall we go against Ramoth-Gilead to battle, or shall I refrain?' And they said, 'Go up, for God will give it into the hand of the king.' But Jehoshaphat said, 'Is there not yet a prophet of the Lord here that we may inquire of him?' The king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, 'There is yet one man by whom we may inquire of the Lord, but I hate him, for he never prophesies good concerning me, but always evil. He is Micaiah, son of Imlah.' But Jehoshaphat said, 'Let not the king say so.' Then the king of Israel called an officer and said, 'Bring quickly Micaiah, Imlah's son.' Now the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, were sitting each on his throne, arrayed in their robes, and they were sitting at the threshing floor at the entrance of the gate of Samaria, and all the prophets were prophesying before them. Zedekiah, the son of Chineah, made horns of iron for himself and said, 'Thus saith the Lord, with these you will gore the Arameans until they are consumed.' All the prophets were prophesying thus, saying, 'Go up to Ramoth-Gilead and succeed, for the Lord will give it into the hand of the king.' Then the messenger who went to summon Micaiah spoke to him, saying, 'Behold, the words of the prophets are uniformly favorable to the king. So please let your word be like one of them and speak favorably.' But Micaiah said, 'As the Lord lives, what my God says, that I will speak.' Then he came to the king, and the king said to him, 'Micaiah, shall we go up to Ramoth-Gilead to battle, or shall I refrain?' He said, 'Go up and succeed, for they will be given into your hand.' Then the king said to him, 'How many times must I adjure you to speak to me nothing but the truth in the name of the Lord?' So he said, 'I saw all Israel scattered on the mountains like sheep which have no shepherd. And the Lord said, "These have no master. Let each one of them return to his house in peace." Then the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, 'Did I not tell you that he would not prophesy good concerning me, but evil?' Micaiah said, 'Therefore hear the word of the Lord. I saw the Lord sitting on his throne, and all the hosts of heaven standing on his right and on his left. The Lord said, "Who will entice Ahab, king of Israel, to go up at fall at Ramoth-Gilead?" And one said this while another said that. Then a spirit came forward and stood before the Lord and said, "I will entice him." And the Lord said to him, "How?" And he said, "I will go and be a deceiving spirit in the mouth of all of his prophets." Then he said, "You are to entice him and prevail also. Go and do so. Now therefore, behold, the Lord has put a deceiving spirit in the mouth of these your prophets, for the Lord has proclaimed disaster against you." Then Zedekiah, the son of Chineah, came near and struck Micaiah on the cheek and said, "How did the spirit of the Lord pass from me to speak to you?" Micaiah said, "Behold, you will see on that day when you enter the inner room to hide yourself." Then the king of Israel said, "Take Micaiah and return him to Amon, the governor of the city, and to Joash, the king's son, and say, 'Thus says the king, put this man in prison and feed him sparingly with bread and water until I return safely.'" Micaiah said, "If you indeed return safely, the Lord has not spoken by me." And he said, "Listen, all you people." Now, I wanted to go that far before we conclude this chapter and just stop there, because you got to get the whole drift of what's taking place here. And, you know, just in a nutshell, what's happened here is, like I said, you've got this King Jehoshaphat, and he is a godly king. He's pretty well committed to God, and he's really obeying God and following God and doing everything he can to encourage his kingdom, you know, to worship God and be faithful to him. And he actually makes some pretty big mistakes. And the big mistake that he makes is he aligns himself with Ahab, who is the king of the northern tribes. Now, Ahab is one of the most notoriously wicked kings in the northern Israel. All right, anybody know who his wife was?
Jezebel.
She was totally wicked, totally a blasphemer, a total idolatrous worshiper. I mean, you know, the Bible has nothing good to say about this Jezebel that he ended up marrying. But here's the problem with this Jehoshaphat, is he has a son named Joram, and he made this alliance with Ahab in terms of marriage. Joram, you know, Jehoshaphat's son, ended up marrying Ahab and Jezebel's daughter, Athaliah. So there was a political alliance there, and I'm sure it was done for political reasons. But here's the problem here, is you've got a godly king, and now he's aligning himself with a very ungodly man. Now, what did Paul tell us in Corinthians? He says, be not deceived. Bad company does what?
Corrupts
good morals. I'm going to repeat that because it says that in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 33. Mm-hmm. Be not deceived. Bad company corrupts good morals. And I've said it many, many, many times over the years. Show me the company that you keep, and I'll show you what kind of person that you are. You know, it doesn't say anything about you in terms of who you hang around with on your job or your place of employment, where you have to be, all right, in regards to your obligations and responsibilities. But it says a lot about us when we get off of that job or that, you know, get out of school or whatever it is, and then who do we gravitate towards? Who do we gravitate to be around, all right? That'll say a lot about us, and I'm telling you what, I've said it many, many times over the years. You're going to hang around with blasphemers, you're going to become a blasphemer. You're going to hang around with the immoral, you're going to become immoral. You're going to hang around with thieves, you're going to become a thief. You're going to hang around with the idolaters, you're going to become an adulterer. You're going to hang around with criminals, I'll see you behind bars. It just goes hand in glove. It really does. And that's what the Bible says. Don't be deceived. Bad company corrupts good morals. Now, Paul didn't come out and says and just simply say, bad company corrupts good morals. He says, be not deceived. Implying what?
You think you can get away with it.
Yes, you kind of can rationalize, justify, excuse, and I'm sure this is what Jehoshaphat did. But the Bible is saying, don't be deceived. You're going to hang around these kind of people. It's going to bring you down. But now, back up with this verse 1 of chapter 18 of 2 Chronicles. It says, now Jehoshaphat had great riches and honor, and he aligned himself by marriage with Ahab. And I just said that he ended up having his son marrying Ahab's daughter. But I think it's kind of significant when it just simply says Jehoshaphat had great riches and honor, because we were just reading last week in chapter 17, verse 3 through 5, this is what it says. The Lord was with Jehoshaphat because he followed the example of his father David's earlier days and did not seek the Baals, but he sought the God of his fathers, followed his commandments, and did not act as Israel did. So the Lord established the kingdom in his control, and all Judah brought tribute to Jehoshaphat, and he had great riches and honor. Now this is repeated. God is really blessing this man in every way, including prospering him monetarily, you know, economically. He's really prospering his entire kingdom. Why? Because I just read it here about Jehoshaphat. He was the type of person who did what? It says that he he sought the God of his fathers and followed his commandments and did not act as Israel did. In other words, he didn't act as the northern kingdom in worshiping these false gods or these golden calves or any other thing. But now, look at the contrast between how God will really bless a nation and he will bless a king, his administration, when they really try to honor him and obey him and follow him and respect him and try to encourage and challenge and just inspire and motivate those under their leadership to do the same. Look at how God ends up blessing this man. But now contrast it with our own country. We are really going, we're bankrupt. We're so bankrupt right now, we will never, ever get out of debt. But does anybody realize that that's spiritual? What we need is to always go back where it says in Chronicles, if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and I will heal their land. So that's what it's going to take. Okay, but who's got the good grace to see it? Virtually nobody. That's why when you read about this king, this is why God really prospered him. He really blessed him, right? And there was obviously a time in our history as a nation where we really were a prosperous nation.
Surpluses.
Yeah, we had surpluses, but now look at us, all right? But nobody sees this. Nobody can comprehend this. Nobody can understand it because we're passing more and more laws and more legislation that's an affront to God, that is at war with God, that is acting with more and more hostility towards God. But nobody seems to understand it. You know what? There's a correlation between what's happening to us financially and what's happening, you know, in regards to what we're doing as far as God's moral laws that we're trampling underfoot. And I just say that in passing because it does say a lot about this Jehoshaphat and how God blessed him. But he makes a mistake here. He aligns himself with a very wicked king. And it says here in that verse 2, it says, some years later he went down to visit Ahab in Samaria, and Ahab slaughtered many sheep and oxen for him and the people who were with him and induced him to go up against Ramoth-Gilead. Now, I don't know if you can see it on this map here, but Ramoth-Gilead is right here. And then Samaria is right over here. So we're talking about 40 miles due east of Samaria, which is the capital of the northern tribes here. This is Ramoth-Gilead. But Ramoth-Gilead, that used to belong to God's people. But the Syrians came down and they constantly did raids on the tribes on the east side of the Jordan because these people were virtually the first ones to go into idolatry. So more and more they were getting their land taken from them. Even though this was a very, very fertile land, it was very, very conducive for livestock and for cattle, for flocks and for herds, everything. This land was very rich, all right? But now they're losing it all, just like our country. It was very rich, very wealthy, but now we're just losing all. So this Ahab decides, you know what, we want to get this territory back. We want to get this land back. This really belongs to us. So he proposes that Jehoshaphat, the king of the south, go in alliance with him, and they both attack the Syrians over there in Ramoth-Gilead. Now, I think what's interesting, look what this Jehoshaphat says, because it says in that verse 3, Ahab, the king of Israel, said to Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, will you go with me against Ramoth-Gilead? And he said to him, I am as you are, and my people as your people, and we will be with you in battle. Now, he has decided, okay, I'm going to do this. But then he says, moreover, Jehoshaphat said to the king of Israel, please inquire first for the word of the Lord. Now, I quite frankly think he should have said that first before he committed his people, his troops, to this endeavor, all right? Because people can do this. It's almost as though Jehoshaphat, what he's done now, is says, okay, we're going to do this. But then he decides, well, maybe we'll pray about it. But whenever we decide we're going to do something and then decide to pray as an afterthought, it's almost invariably, it's a situation where all we want God to do is just come along and rubber stamp what we've already decided we're going to do. And I think that that's what happened. And I really think he's making a mistake here. Because look at that verse 4. Moreover, Jehoshaphat said to the king of Israel, please inquire first for the word of the Lord. Then the king of Israel assembled the prophets, 400 men, and said to them, shall we go up against Ramoth-Gilead to battle, or shall I refrain? And they said, go up, for God will give it into the hand of the king. But Jehoshaphat says, is there not yet a prophet of the Lord here that we may inquire of him? The king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, there is yet one man by whom we may inquire of the Lord, but I hate him, for he never prophesies good concerning me, but always evil. He is Micaiah the son of Imlah. But Jehoshaphat said, let not the king say so. So I think what's kind of instructive about this is this. Okay. This king, Ahab, gets 400 prophets together, and these are the prophets of Baal. And they're all in agreement, saying, yeah, go up to Ramoth-Gilead. God's going to give you the victory, and you're going to defeat these people, and you're going to get this land back. They're all saying the same thing. But what's kind of interesting is you've got 400 men, 400 prophets here. But interesting thing to me is, you know, of course, we haven't gone through it in the Chronicles here, but in the Kings, there was that situation with Elijah. And Elijah confronted 450 prophets of Baal, and he also confronted 400 prophets of Asherah. We read that in 1 Kings chapter 18. And then he defeats all these people. In other words, that was when they called down fire from heaven, all right, and it consumed the sacrifice, and then Elijah said, take all these prophets down there and kill them. So they got rid of all these prophets, but apparently they've come back now. When I say they've come back is now they're all replaced, right? They're all replaced. I mean, what does that suggest to you spiritually?
The forces of wickedness, they just don't give up.
Oh, yeah, constantly, continuously. That's why we always, I think, really have to be vigilant and diligent when it comes to dealing with the powers of darkness, and it comes to dealing with, idolatrous practices, and comes to dealing with all these things that are front to God. It's almost like there's never a situation where we can just sit back and say, well, okay, we got the victory, because it's always going to come back. It's interesting to me that Elijah got rid of all these prophets, and now you got 400 more of them. Now they're just cropping up, right? Mm-hmm. And they're all in agreement. They're all telling the same thing. But Jehoshaphat, it appears, he has enough discernment to say, you know what, there's something fishy about this. There's something not right here. He discerns that there's nobody speaking for the Lord here. Now, I think that's kind of commendable, but I think, once again, even though he discerns this, he's not following through on his discernment, because we read here clearly, when he does have a prophet of the Lord come before him, he doesn't listen to him. And I would just say this in passing too. It's just, I think discernment is something that's really, really, really needed today. And I think it's really, really lacking today in the church, and unfortunately even in a lot of the pulpits today. But what is discernment?
Discerning the spirit, what's behind the actions or intentions of...
Yeah, you can just kind of discern. You know, I mean, on our physical body, everything in our physical body has a spiritual parallel. What's discernment in our spirit that has a physical parallel? It's our nose. It's our nose. In other words, you would think to yourself, you know what? This doesn't smell right. This does not smell right. That's discernment. You see what I'm saying? This smells fishy. There's something wrong here. All right? I remember as a new Christian, everything was new to me in terms of the Bible, in terms of, all the Bible prophecy, in terms of, all these different gifts. I mean, it was all new to me. I was kind of excited, reading about all the gifts of the Spirit, the gifts of healing, the gifts of miracles, the gifts of tongues, interpretations of tongues, the gifts of all of these different gifts. And I thought to myself one time as a young Christian, I thought, you know what, it would really be neat to have the gift of miracles or the gift of healing, just lay hands on somebody and say, being healed. I really gave that a lot of thought. I thought, thought to myself, that would be nice to have, but that kind of thing, I think, would just, I couldn't handle that kind of gift. Mm-hmm. It would just call too much attention to myself. But I do know I was dealing with a lot of cults and a lot of people that had a different take on the Bible than others. Even within the church, there was so much what I consider to be confusion and, just a lot of slinging hats and, splitting hairs about, a lot of, immaterial things. Anyway, I do remember feeling frustrated one night, and I walked into church. I was all alone. I just knelt down. I said, Lord, I don't know if you have a gift for me or not, but if I can only have one gift, I really pray for the gift of discernment. I feel like I really need that gift. I really got to know what's from you, what's from the devil, what's from my own deceitful heart, what's right, what's wrong, what's true, what's false, what's good, what's evil. I really think that we need this today. Well, apparently Jehoshaphat had enough discernment to say, you know what, there's not a prophet of God speaking here. All right, and this is what he says to the king in that verse 6 of 2 Chronicles chapter 18. But Jehoshaphat said, is there not yet a prophet of the Lord here that we may inquire of him? The king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, there is yet one man by whom we may inquire of the Lord, but I hate him, for he never prophesies good concerning me, but always evil. He is Micaiah, the son of Imlah. But Jehoshaphat said, let not the king say so. In verse 8, then the king of Israel called an officer and said, bring Micaiah, Imlah's son. Now, what's interesting about this, and I read it in the book of Josephus, is that Micaiah is in prison. He's in jail. They don't have to go very far to get him, all right? And he's in jail because he does nothing but prophesy evil against Ahab.
Evil.
Right?
Yeah.
He said, you know, he just is constantly in his face. And so now he's thrown into the slammer, right? So he only has to go down to the, you know, down the block to get him, right? And this is what it says in verse 9. He says, "Now the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, were sitting each on his thrones, arrayed in their robes. And they were sitting at the threshing floor at the entrance of the gate of Samaria. And all the prophets were prophesying before him. Zedekiah, the son of Chineah, made horns, made horns of iron for himself and said, 'Thus saith the Lord, with these you shall gore the Arameans until they are consumed.' And all the prophets were prophesying thus, saying, 'Go up to Ramoth Gilead and succeed, for the Lord will give it into the hand of the king.'" Now, you got 400 people here, and they're all prophesying the same thing. And this Zedekiah is their leader. All right, he is their spokesman, and I think he's getting a little, I think, dramatic, don't you think? Because he makes horns of iron. I don't know if they had the horns that were put on a helmet, or if he just has them and he's running back and forth, you know, like a big fool, like a bull, trying to show him that, well, you're going to gain victory over the enemy, or your enemies here. And in verse 12 it says, "Then the messenger who went to summon Micaiah spoke to him, saying, 'Behold, the words of the prophets are uniformly favorable to the king. So please let your word be like one of them and speak favorably.' But Micaiah said, 'As the Lord lives, what my God says, that I will speak.'" Now, this is kind of interesting. This guy that went to get him, we are told in Josephus that he was a eunuch, and I guess maybe he was in the king's court or entourage, or maybe one of his bodyguards, I don't know. But he goes and gets Micaiah. He gets him out of jail. And as they're going to where these guys have their throne set up, they're going to speak to this king, this eunuch says to him, "Hey, listen, everybody's given a favorable report. Why don't you do the smart thing and get on board and just go along with what they're saying?" And then he makes this statement. He says, "I'm only going to speak what God tells me to speak." All right? Now, this is what's interesting. I want to see what's thinking here, because it says this. Verse 14, "When he came to the king said to him, 'Micaiah, shall we go up to Ramoth Gilead to battle, or shall I refrain?' And he said, 'Go up and succeed, for they will be given into your hand.' Then the king said to him, 'How many times must I adjure you to speak to me nothing but the truth in the name of the Lord?'" Now, interesting thing. He just told this bodyguard, "I'm only going to speak what God tells me to speak." And then, when he's standing there in front of these two kings, they said, "Should we go up?" He says, "Yeah, go up and succeed." And the king knows he's not being genuine. But why would Micaiah do that? Why would he say, "Go up and succeed," when he just told this other guy, "I'm only going to speak what God tells me to speak"? Who's thinking here?
God knows they're not
going to
listen to
that,
him anyway.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly it. It's like, hey, yeah, go up and succeed, fool. Knowing, it doesn't matter what I tell you, you're going to do what you want to do.
Yeah.
See, how many people are like that today? How many people are like that? And remember what Paul says in Timothy, 2 Timothy? I always go back to it. He says this, that all scripture is inspired by God and profitable for teaching, for reproof, for correction, for training in righteousness, so that the man of God may be adequate, equipped for every good work. I solemnly charge you in the presence of God and of Christ Jesus, who is to judge the living and the dead, and by his appearing in his kingdom, preach the word. It's what Micaiah is going to do. Preach the word. Be ready in season and out of season. Reprove, rebuke, exhort with great patience and instruction. For the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but wanting to have their ears tickled. Now, is Ahab wanting to have his ears tickled?
Mm-hmm.
Wanting to have their ears tickled, they will accumulate for themselves teachers, and according to their own desires, or accumulate for themselves prophets, right? In accordance to their own desires, and will turn their ears for the truth, and will turn aside to myths. Now, this is exactly what Micaiah is thinking. It's kind of like, you know what? You're not going to listen to what I say, so just go up and succeed. But now the king knows he's just flim-flamming me, and says this in verse 15. Then the king said to him, "How many times must I adjure you to speak to me nothing but the truth in the name of the Lord?" Now, this has been an ongoing thing. All right? He's a prophet. Ahab knows he's a prophet. And apparently, over and over again, he just flippantly says, "Yeah, go ahead, go ahead, go ahead. Who gives a hoot? Go, you know." Because he knows you're not going to listen to me anyway. You see, it's almost like, don't confuse me with the facts. My mind is made up. And how many people are like that in the church today? Like, God has made himself abundantly clear on so many different issues and in so many different ways. But we're not about to listen to him. Look at how God is going to judge him now. It's almost like you see a poetic justice here, or you can see how God will judge in a poetic fashion. And that's this. This guy will not listen to God's true prophet. So now God's going to judge him with false prophets. Mm-hmm. Now here's the thing too. What's the very first thing that led the list that Jesus Christ described when he was describing all the things that are going to precede his second coming? What's the thing that leads the list?
False prophets.
Matthew 24. And I think it's Luke 21. He says, beware, be watchful, be on guard, because there are going to be many false Christs, many false prophets, to mislead many, if possible, even elect. This is what the warning was. It led the list of everything to look for in terms of a sign to the times, in terms of Jesus Christ's return, is false prophets. And here's the thing. People more and more, inside the church, outside the church, all over this world, especially all over this country, we're not listening to God. We're not listening to what he has said. So, you know how God's going to judge this world? With a false prophet. There's going to be a world leader and a false prophet. Now, let me see who's thinking here. Because now in that verse 15, then the king said to him, how many times must I adjure you to speak to me nothing but the truth in the name of the Lord? Now, he's adjuring him, okay, to speak the truth in the name of the Lord. Remember when Jesus Christ was standing before Caiaphas and, he was standing before all these, the Sanhedrin or the religious leaders when he was being on trial and being going to be railroaded to his death? All right. Caiaphas was just asking him questions, and Jesus Christ would not give him the time of day until he said what?
Are you the Messiah?
I adjure you by the living God.
Yes, I adjure you by the living God. All right. To tell me the truth here, in terms of, are you the Messiah? And then Jesus Christ said, basically, I am.
And then you
see, that's the thing. Jesus Christ didn't say anything until he adjured him in the name of the living God. This is the same thing here. Micah wasn't going to give him the time of day until he says, okay, you better speak in the name of God here, right? Yeah. So this is what he says. So he said, I saw all Israel scattered on the mountains like sheep which have no shepherd. And the Lord said, these have no master. Let each of them return to his house. Then the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, did I not tell you that he would not prophesy good concerning me, but evil? See, this is what Micah sees. He sees all Israel scattered. They're going to be routed. They're going to be in retreat. They're going to end up being humiliated. And then it says in verse 18, Micah said, therefore, hear the word of the Lord. I saw the Lord sitting on his throne, and all the hosts of heaven standing on his right and on his left. And the Lord said, who will entice Ahab of Israel to go up and fall at Ramoth Gilead? And one said this, while another said that. Then a spirit came forward and stood before the Lord and said, I will entice him. And the Lord said to him, how? And he said, I will go to be a deceiving spirit in the mouth of all of his prophets. Then he said, you are to entice him and prevail also. Go and do so. Now therefore, behold, the Lord has put a deceiving spirit in the mouth of these your prophets, for the Lord has proclaimed disaster against you. Now, here's the thing. Think hard, think deep, because now Micah, what he's saying here, says, I saw God high and lifted up, and I saw, this his whole court filled with the spirits, in other words, angels. Mm-hmm. And then God is throwing out a challenge or throwing out a question to all those in his court. He says this, in verse 19, the Lord said, who will entice Ahab, king of Israel, to go up against Ramoth-Gilead? And one said this while another said that. And then a spirit comes forward and says, that he would entice him. And God says, how? And he says, I will go and be a deceiving spirit in the mouth of all his prophets. Now, here's the thing. In my opinion, this is not an angel.
That's a demon.
This is a demon. And then people say, well, what's a demon doing in heaven? But we know for certain that Satan and demons have access to heaven. Why do we know that?
Satan goes before God and talks to him and taunts him.
Job.
Yeah, good. Yeah. In Job, we are told that the sons of God or the angels of God came before to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came with them, right? Mm-hmm. And then God threw out that challenge in regards to Job. But we're also told in Revelation that 3.5 years into the tribulation period, Satan is going to make an all-out assault against heaven with all of his demonic hordes, all right? And then he's going to be thrown down. He's never going to have access to heaven again. But when he's thrown down, we read about this in Revelation chapter 13. It says that he stands before God day and night and does what?
Accusing
the brethren. So he's up there constantly, day and night, accusing the brethren. But understand something about Satan. He's not omnipresent. He can't be everywhere like God. But he can be in a lot of places at one time. But he's not omnipresent, all right? But he certainly has a great deal of power. And he's on earth constantly, roaming to and fro upon the earth, seeking whom he can devour. But he's also in heaven, day and night, accusing the brethren. So he has access, and so do demonic spirits. But now, think hard, think deep. If I'm correct, which I believe I am, and this is a demonic spirit, why would he want to help God out here? You would think, well, why would he do that?
He's deceiving God's people.
Yes, because this demonic spirit knows, you know what? I'll do this. I'll do your bidding, God. I'll go down there, and I'll become a deceiving spirit in the mouths of all these prophets. It's not that he wants to help God out, but you know, his ultimate goal, as well as all demonic spirits and Satan, is to destroy God's people. He wants to see them defeated. He wants to see them destroyed. He wants to see them humiliated. This is what they want, all right, is to destroy God's people. They would do that, all right? Same thing with the church. If there was demonic spirits up there, and they would be delighted to come down and, let's say, put a deceiving spirit into people who are in the pulpit. Well, God might allow that as a judgment, but you see, they delight in doing that because they want to destroy the church, or they want to destroy God's people. See, does it make sense to you now? Yeah. Now look at verse 23. Then Zedekiah, the son of Chineah, came near and struck Micah on the cheek and said, "How did the Spirit of the Lord pass from me to speak to you?" Verse 24, Micah said, "Behold, you will see on the day when you enter the inner room and hide yourself." Now, what does he mean by that?
Going to be overtaken, and he's going to run for his life.
Well, Zedekiah and the prophets are going to stay there in Samaria. All right, they're not going out to this battle, but this is what it says in the book of Josephus. It says this: "But Micah replied to Zedekiah, 'In a few days you should go from one secret chamber to another to hide yourself, that he might escape the punishment for his lying.'" In other words, he's going to be there. He's staying behind while the army's going out to fight. But when Ahab is killed and his armies are defeated, now everybody's going to know, this guy's a lion worth his goods for nothing. So he's just going from chamber to chamber trying to hide from people who are going to execute him, basically. Because that's what he's saying here. Now, verse 24, Micah said, "Behold, you will see on the day when you enter the inner room to hide yourself." Then the king of Israel said, "Take Micah and return him to Amon, the governor of the city, and to Joash, the king's son, and say, 'Thus says the king, put this man in prison and feed him sparingly with bread and water until I return.'" And Micah said, "If you indeed return safely, the Lord has not spoken by me." And he said, "Listen, all you people." So what does it mean when he says, "Listen, all you people"?
Mark my words.
Yes. Just get that picture. You got these kings on their thrones, and they're surrounded by a whole entourage of, you know, court officials. So Micah, as he's being led away, probably in handcuffs or whatever, right? He says, "Listen up, all you people. You're witnesses." Right? And now winding this chapter down, verse 28. "So the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, went up against Ramoth-Gilead. And the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, 'I will disguise myself and go into battle, but you put on your robes.' So the king of Israel disguised himself, and they went into battle. Now the king of Aram had commanded the captains of the chariot, saying, 'Do not fight with small or great, but with the king of Israel alone.' So when the captains of the chariot saw Jehoshaphat, they said, 'It is the king of Israel.' And they turned aside to fight against him. But Jehoshaphat cried out, and the Lord helped him, and God diverted them from him. When the captains of the chariot saw that it was not the king of Israel, they turned back from pursuing him. A certain man drew his bow at random and struck the king of Israel in the joint of his armor. So he said to the driver of the chariot, "Turn around and take me out of the fight, for I am severely wounded." The battle raged that day, and the king of Israel propped himself up in his chariot in front of the Arameans until evening, and at sunset he died. Now, this is, I don't know about this Jehoshaphat. I mean, he is a godly man, but look, man, he's just a dupe. I mean, look at this. Look at this verse 29. The king of Israel, that's Ahab, said to Jehoshaphat, "I will disguise myself and go into battle, but you put on your robes." So the king of Israel disguised himself and they went into battle. Now, why would Ahab want him to do that? And why is Ahab only going to go into battle as a dressed as an ordinary soldier and not in his kingly robes?
He'll target him and he'll target the other guy. Mm-hmm. Draw him off.
There must be something nagging him deep down inside, saying, "Man, Micah might be right. Micaiah might be right." So he figures, "Oh, Jehoshaphat, you go in your kingly robes." So Jehoshaphat, what a dupe. It's kind of like, well, he's just being a patsy here, right? He should have known that they were going to be gunning for him, right? So Ahab goes into battle. He's just dressed as an ordinary soldier. And then, of course, it's exactly what Ahab wanted, is that the Syrian army, the Arameans, are going to see Jehoshaphat and think, "Well, here's a guy. Let's do him in." Okay, so they start pursuing him because that was the command of the commander of the Aramean army, of the Syrian army. Said, "Hey, man, don't even bother fighting in this battle. You find out where that king is. You throw everything you got at that king. You know, cut off the head, and this thing will be over with, right?" So they're starting to pursue Jehoshaphat, and Jehoshaphat says, cries out. Now, what does that mean?
Praise.
Man, it's an arrow prayer, right? And God was merciful to him because he's a man who I really feel had a heart for God and tried for God. He's not showing a lot of discernment here, and he's doing some foolish things, but God is merciful to him. But here's the thing about an arrow prayer. I do not believe that arrow prayers are going to be effective for anyone who does not have a consistent prayer life. You know what I mean by an arrow prayer?
Yeah.
And look at Nehemiah, for example. Here was a guy who really had a relationship with God dialed in. Just dialed in. And he fasted, he prayed, he really sought God with all of his heart, tried to follow God's laws and his God's commandments. And he was the wine taster for the king. And he really, really was distressed, Nehemiah, about, you know, the walls of the city of Jerusalem having been so destroyed because of what happened in regards to God's judgments when he had the Babylonians destroy Jerusalem, and he wanted to rebuild the wall. Anyways, long story short, when the king, when he went in as a cupbearer, he was to taste the king's food and also to drink the king's wine to make sure what? Nobody's trying to poison him, right? And you couldn't be just any flunky, you know, to just say, "Hey, drink this, see if you drop dead." No, you had to really be able to hold yourself well, and you always had to be very cheerful in the presence of a king, otherwise you'd lose your head. Well, Nehemiah was really, I think, depressed about this whole situation with Jerusalem, and he goes into the king's presence, and the king says to him, "Hey, why are you so down?" And then it says, and he prayed to the God of heaven, like, "Oh God, help me," because the king asked him, you know, what he wanted him to do about Jerusalem. So, I know, I didn't want to get off on a tangent there, but I think that arrow prayers only work for people who have a prayer life dialed in. Yeah. You can't be living like hell and then find yourself, you know, being chased by the cops and say, "Oh, Lord, help me." That ain't going to work, man. That arrow prayer is not going to work at all.
God won't be mocked.
All right?
Yeah.
But
there is an example of an arrow prayer that worked for someone who didn't live for God.
That's true.
The thief on the cross.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was a sincere prayer.
Yeah, it was.
That wasn't just a, you know, living like hell and then, right.
Yeah.
Didn't get him off the cross.
Right.
Yeah.
See, it got him into heaven, but it didn't get him out of his circumstance, right? All right, but that was a good point. Anyway, when you look at this verse 31, so when the captains of the chariot saw Jehoshaphat, they said, "It is the king of Israel," and they turned aside and they fought against him. But Jehoshaphat cried out, and the Lord helped him, and God diverted them from him. And when the captains of the chariot saw that it was not the king of Israel, they turned back from pursuing him. In other words, they had one goal, get that king, right? They're not even going to mess with anybody else. And then in verse 33, it says, a certain man drew his bow at random and struck the king of Israel in the joint of his armor. So he said to the driver of the chariot, "Turn around and take me out of the fight, for I am severely wounded." Now, it says here, a certain man drew his bow, and he just Let this arrow fly. Now, this arrow had Ahab's name on it. All right? Even though this man just did it at random.
Yeah.
Any idea who this man was? Maybe I'm not really being fair with you guys, because I get this information from Josephus.
Uh-huh.
This was none other than Naaman. None other than Naaman is the one that shot this arrow. And if you remember, we were... But I'm saying, I don't put 100% credence in Josephus' writings, or like I do the Bible, but it does fill in a lot of information.
It's historical.
All right,
but it's not scripture.
I'll give you an example. If you go back to 2 Kings chapter 5, it says this: Now Naaman, captain of the army, the king of Aram, was a great man with his master and highly respected, because by him the Lord had given victory to Aram.
Oh.
The man was also a valiant warrior, but he was a leper. Now that victory was, he was given the credit for shooting that arrow. Right?
Where was that again?
That was 2 Kings chapter 5, verse 1.
Hmm.
I want to read again. Now Naaman, the captain of the army, the king of Aram, was a great man with his master and highly respected, because by him the Lord had given victory to Aram, or to Syria. That was the incident, right? And I do think it's kind of interesting that it says, but he was a leper. Hmm. Now, anybody remember how he was cured of his leprosy?
He had to go to the sea 7 times, or go to a lake. Sometimes.
Well, here's the thing. When he got back to Syria, okay, up there in Damascus, and then he came down with this leprosy, some kind of skin disease, and then when he went back up to Damascus, he actually took a slave girl, all right, a young girl, as a slave from Israel. And he gets up there, and then the slave girl says to him one day, I wish my master would go down to Israel, because there's a prophet down there by the name of Elijah, and he can heal you. Anyway, long story short, Naaman goes down there, and he ends up going to Elijah's house. And
the first time you said Elijah, and Elisha.
It's Elisha.
Right.
All right. They sound so similar. Yeah. Not Elijah, but Elisha. He goes down to Elijah's house. Anyway, long story short, Elijah comes out and says, oh, no, it wasn't even Elijah comes out. It was Gehazi, Elisha's servant, came out, and he said, go dip into Jordan 7 times. And now Naaman's all ticked off. He's just all... infuriated. Man, he said, I'm an important man. This guy's not even going to come out, and he thought he would wave his hand over me or cure him or heal him or something. But then he's so angry, all right, and he's just pacing back and forth, and he's basically, I guess, cussing under his breath until one of his captains or his bodyguard comes up to him and says, hey, listen, if the guy told you to do something really, really, really difficult, wouldn't you do it? He says, he's telling you to do something very simple. Why don't you do it? So I said, okay, I'll do it. He goes down to Jordan, dips in 7 times, comes up completely healed of his leprosy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then he goes back to Elijah's house and tries to give him a reward, but Elijah won't take it. And that's when Gehazi lied to him, and Gehazi ended up getting Naaman's leprosy because of his lying. But here's an interesting thing. When did Jesus Christ refer to Naaman?
In reference to the Gentiles, believing, but not his people.
Yeah, well, it's actually when he went back to his own hometown. It says this in Luke chapter 4.
About can't do miracles in your own town or something.
And it says this, that's when Jesus Christ was in the synagogue and he read from this roll of the scroll of Isaiah. Oh, and it goes on to say this. And he began to say to them, today this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing. And all were speaking well of him and wondering at the gracious words which were falling from his lips. And they were saying, is this not Joseph's son? And he, Jesus, said to them, no doubt you will quote this proverb to me, physician, heal yourself. Whatever we heard was done at Capernaum, do here in our own hometown as well. And he, Jesus, said, truly I say to you, no prophet is welcome in his own hometown. But I say to you in truth that there were many widows in Israel in the days of Elijah, when the sky was shut up for 3 years and for 6 months, and when the great famine had come all over the land. And yet Elijah was sent to none of them, but only to Zarephath, to the land of Sidon, to a woman who was a widow. And there were many lepers in Israel in the time of Elisha, the prophet, and none of them was cleansed, but only Naaman the Syrian. And all the people in the synagogue were filled with rage as they heard these things. And they got up and they drove him out of the city and led him to the brow of the hill on which their city had been built in order to throw him down the cliff. But passing through their midst, he went his way. Now, that's when Jesus Christ referred to Naaman. Mm-hmm. Now, we're just over here about reading a guy who just shot at random, and that arrow had his name on it. But interesting thing, where did that arrow strike him?
Right between the chink in the armor.
Yes, I guess it was probably right here on the side, because it was probably bolted together, like you had that, it was two pieces, you know, the front piece and the back, and it probably strapped together, you know, underneath his arms. And that arrow found its way between the metal front and the back. Yeah. Now, here's the thing. Just spiritually speaking, what does a breastplate represent?
Righteousness.
The breastplate of righteousness. And Satan is always looking for a chink in our armor, man. That's why it's so important to, you know, to be living a life of integrity and righteousness. Okay, but this guy, he was a worthless good for nothing, and God just
ruled. I
believe
that he had integrity, though. But I don't believe that he was righteous. And the reason I say that is because when he asked them, when the two kings were sitting up in their party clothes, he asked them, why don't you want to call the prophet of the Lord? And he told him exactly why. He didn't try and cloak it. He was
integrity
enough to come right out and say something that's probably not popular.
Yeah.
And not only that, the other king recognized it and said, you shouldn't talk like that.
Well, all right. I see what you're saying, but, you know, just keep this in mind. Even a busted clock is right two times a day. I mean, a person could be lying all their life, and if they tell the truth, doesn't mean that in one instance, doesn't mean that they're... Yeah. But anybody have any want to add or share?
Well, I was just curious, why does he prop himself up in front of the Aramean?
Good.
Put on
why?
To act like he's still in control.
Right.
Try to buffalo and see if he can win.
Because he's still, you know, it's almost as though he's got, God is speaking to him over and over and over and over and over again, and he's still defiant to the end. He figures, you know what? I'm hit, but if I just keep propping myself up like this, my army's going to think I'm still in the battle, and they're not going to flee. So he's hanging on, thinking, "Well, I can still eke out a victory here." You know, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
He is just defiant to the end. Now, I just want to quickly conclude with this chapter 19, because the two go hand in hand. This chapter 18, 19 is. Chapter 19, verse 1, it says, then Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, returned in safety to his house in Jerusalem. Jehu, the son of Hanani, the seer, went out to meet him and said to the king, Jehoshaphat, should you help the wicked and love those who hate the Lord and so bring wrath on yourself from the Lord? But there is some good in you, for you have removed the Asherah from the land, and you have set your heart to seek God. So Jehoshaphat lived in Jerusalem and went out again among the people from Beersheba to the hill country of Ephraim and brought them back to the Lord, the God of their fathers. Mm-hmm. Now, Jehoshaphat's rebuked, all right, by a prophet of God. He gets back to his own hometown there in Jerusalem, and obviously he came back with an army that's been greatly reduced, all right, and humiliated. And then he's rebuked. And look at the way he's rebuked, because this prophet says to him, should you help the wicked and love those who hate the Lord and so bring wrath on yourself from the Lord? Now, I'm going to tell you right now, even though people are going to despise me for saying this, I'm telling you right now, anybody who is claiming to be a Christian and they go out and they vote for these politicians who promote gay marriage, who promote the whole homosexual agenda, who promote the murder of unborn children, what do you think you're doing? Read it right here. Should you help the wicked and love those who hate the Lord and so bring wrath on yourself from the Lord?
Right.
This is exactly what people are doing in this country. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And believe me, when they go to the polls and vote for these people who are at war with God, just like Ahab and Jezebel were at war with God, you know, that's a sin. And you're going to bring a judgment upon yourself. Mm-hmm. But God in his mercy is saying, well, look, you have done some good things, all right? You removed the Asherah from the land. That was a female deity. In our land, it would be, you know, the equivalent of pornography. And you set your heart to seek God. So God was gracious and merciful to him. But he was still rebuked, right? And then the last few verses in verse 5, he says, he appointed judges in the land, in all the fortified cities of Judah, city by city. He said to the judges, consider what you are doing, for you do not judge for man, but for the Lord who is with you when you render judgment. Now then, let the fear of the Lord be upon you. Be very careful what you do, for the Lord our God will have no part in unrighteousness or partiality or the taking of a bribe. In Jerusalem also Jehoshaphat appointed some of the Levites and the priests and some of the heads of the fathers' households of Israel for the judgment of the Lord and to judge disputes among the inhabitants of Jerusalem. Then he charged them, saying, thus you shall do in the fear of the Lord, faithfully and wholeheartedly. Whenever any dispute comes to you from your brethren who live in their cities, between blood and blood, between law and commandment, statutes and ordinances, you shall warn them so that they may not be guilty before the Lord, and wrath not come on you and your brethren. Thus you should do, and you will not be guilty. Behold, Amariah the chief priest will be over you in all that pertains to the Lord, and Zebadiah the son of Ishmael, the ruler of the house of Judah, and all that pertains to the king. Also the Levites shall be officers before you. Act resolutely, and the Lord will be with the upright. Now, you got to really hand it to this Jehoshaphat. You know, he's doing everything that he can to promote righteousness and justice and equality before God. In other words, he's telling all these judges, you are to judge rightly, you're not to take a bribe, you're not to act in a partial manner, you're supposed to be impartial in all your judgments and all that you're doing. But look at what we got today. So many of our politicians today, they take bribes, only they don't call them bribes. What do they call them?
Campaign contributions.
What's that? Special interest money. They ought to just, you know, quit messing around with semantics and just call it what it is. Here's bribe money, all right, from an interest group over here. We're paying you $10,000 for your election, for your re-election, or whatever, but you have to vote our way. Now, if that's not bribe money, I don't know what is, right?
Right.
Then it corrupts their vision. It corrupts them totally and completely, because then they're not going to do the right thing, right? And in conclusion here, when we're talking about this this Ahab, and we're talking about the death of Ahab, and we're talking about how Jehoshaphat aligned himself with this man and then was totally humiliated because he did exactly that. But here's the thing. We are told in the account in Kings about this, about the death of Ahab. Mm-hmm. And what happened there was that, first of all, because Ahab stole or basically murdered Naboth, and him and his wife conspired to murder this man and then take his property, there was a pronouncement of judgment upon him when Elijah, the prophet, came to him and said, you know, because you've done this, you've shed this blood of Naboth, your blood is going to be licked up by the dogs in Naboth's vineyard. And he said, and not only that, the dogs are going to eat Jezebel. In other words, he made this pronouncement against them. So, just long story short, because I know we're out of time here, when Ahab, they took his dead body back to Samaria. They washed it in a stream that went through Naboth's vineyard. Mm. But before they got to washing it, the dogs came along and licked his blood off the floor of that chariot. And that's exactly what God pronounced against Ahab because of his his wickedness. And then eventually his wife was thrown out of a tower by Jehu, and his horse trampled her to death, and then the dogs devoured her. But what did the dogs not eat?
The hands.
The hands, and what else?
Feet.
And feet. What does that suggest to you?
Hands quick to do evil and feet running.
It's almost as though even the dogs would need the hands that were so, I think, quick to do so much evil and shed so much blood, and feet that ran to do such evil before God. Now, I know I kind of went off on a tangent there, but I think it was kind of interesting when you tie this all together as far as this war, this battle, and it was actually Naaman, it appears, who was the one who shot that arrow, and he just did it randomly, but that arrow had Ahab's name on it. That was divinely orchestrated, and he met his end. Right? Anybody have anyone to add or share?